nuclear weapon. There seem to be those in the weapons laboratories who consider making bigger bombs not only as a stirring challenge, but also as a way to mute pesky environmentalists by securing a seat for nuclear weapons on the Save the Earth bandwagon. Another approach under more serious discussion is less dramatic, but still an effective way of maintaining the weapons establishment. A plan to alter the orbit of any errant worldlet by exploding nuclear weapons nearby. The explosions, generally near the asteroid's closest point to the sun, are arranged to deflect it away from the Earth. A flurry of low-yield nuclear weapons, each giving a little push in the desired direction, is enough to deflect a medium-sized asteroid with only a few weeks' warning. The method also offers, it is hoped, a way to deal with a suddenly detected long-period comet on imminent collision trajectory with the Earth. The comet would be intercepted with a small asteroid. Needless to say, this game of celestial billiards is even more difficult and uncertain, and therefore even less practical in the near future than the herding of an asteroid on a known, well-behaved orbit with months or years at our disposal. We don't know what a standoff nuclear explosion would do to an asteroid. The answer may vary from asteroid to asteroid. Some small worlds might be strongly held together. Others might be little more than self-gravitating gravel heaps. If an explosion breaks, let's say a 10-kilometer asteroid, up into hundreds of 1-kilometer fragments, the likelihood that at least one of them impacts the Earth is probably increased, and the apocalyptic character of the consequences may not be much reduced. On the other hand, if the explosion disrupts the asteroid into a swarm of objects 100 meters in diameter or smaller, all of them might ablate away like giant meteors on entering the Earth's atmosphere. In this case, little impact damage would be caused. Even if the asteroid were wholly pulverized into fine powder, though, the resulting high-altitude dust layer might be so opaque as to block the sunlight and change the climate. We do not yet know. A vision of dozens or hundreds of nuclear-armed missiles on ready standby to deal with threatening asteroids or comets has been offered. However premature, in this particular application, it seems very familiar. Only the enemy has been changed. It also seems very dangerous. The problem, Stephen Ostrow of JPL and I have suggested, is that if you can reliably deflect a threatening worldlet so it does not collide with the Earth, you can also reliably deflect a harmless worldlet so it does collide with the Earth. Suppose you had a full inventory with orbits of the estimated 300,000 near-Earth asteroids larger than 100 meters, each of them large enough on impacting the Earth to have serious consequences. Then it turns out you also have a list of huge numbers of inoffensive asteroids whose orbits could be altered with nuclear warheads so they quickly collide with the Earth. Suppose we restrict our attention to the 2,000 or so near-Earth asteroids that are a kilometer across or bigger. That is, the ones most likely to cause a global catastrophe. Today, with only about 100 of these objects cataloged, it would take about a century to catch one when it's easily deflectable to Earth and alter its orbit. We think we found one, an as-yet unnamed asteroid, so far denoted only as 1991 OA. In 2070, this world, about 1 kilometer in diameter, will come within 4.5 million kilometers of the Earth's orbit, only 15 times the distance to the moon. To deflect 1991 OA so it hits the Earth, Only about 60 megatons of TNT equivalent needs to be exploded in the right way. The equivalent of a small number of currently available nuclear warheads. Now imagine a time, a few decades hence, when all such near-Earth asteroids are inventoried and their orbits compiled. Then, as Alan Harris of JPL, Greg Canavan of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, Astro, and I have shown, it might take only a year to select a suitable object, alter its orbit, and send it crashing into the Earth with cataclysmic effect. The technology required, large optical telescopes, sensitive detectors, rocket propulsion systems, able to lift a few tons of payload and make precise rendezvous in nearby space, and thermonuclear weapons, all exist today. Improvements on all, but perhaps the last, can be confidently expected. If we're not careful, many nations may have these capabilities in the next few decades. What kind of world will we then have made? We have a tendency to minimize the dangers of new technologies. A year before the Chernobyl disaster, a Soviet nuclear power industry deputy minister was asked about the safety of Soviet reactors and chose Chernobyl as a particularly safe site. The average waiting time to disaster, he confidently estimated, was 100,000 years. Less than a year later, devastation. Similar reassurances were provided by NASA contractors the year before the Challenger disaster. You would have to wait 10,000 years, they estimated, for a catastrophic failure of the shuttle. 1 year later, heartbreak. Chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, were developed specifically as a completely safe refrigerant to replace ammonia and other refrigerants that, on leaking out, had caused illness and some deaths. Chemically inert, non-toxic in ordinary concentrations, odorless, tasteless, non-allergenic, non-flammable, CFCs represent a brilliant technological solution to a well-defined, practical problem. They found uses in many other industries besides refrigeration and air conditioning. But, as I described above, the chemists who developed CFCs overlooked one essential fact: that the molecule's very inertness guarantees that they are circulated to stratospheric altitudes and there cracked open by sunlight, releasing chlorine atoms, which then attack the protective ozone layer. Due to the work of a few scientists, the dangers may have been recognized and averted in time. We humans have now almost stopped producing CFCs. We won't actually know if we've avoided real harm for about a century. That's how long it takes for all the CFC damage to be completed. Like the ancient Cameronians, we make mistakes. Not only do we often ignore the warnings of the oracles, characteristically, we do not even consult them. The notion of moving asteroids into Earth orbit has proved attractive to some space scientists and long-range planners. They foresee mining the minerals and precious metals of these worlds or providing resources for the construction of space infrastructure without having to fight the Earth's gravity to get them up there. Articles have been published on how to accomplish this end and what the benefits will be. In modern discussions, the asteroid is inserted into orbit around the Earth by first making it pass through and be braked by the Earth's atmosphere, a maneuver with very little margin for error. For the near future, we can, I think, recognize this whole endeavor as unusually dangerous and foolhardy, especially for metal worldlets larger than tens of meters across. This is one activity where errors in navigation or propulsion or mission design can have the most sweeping and catastrophic consequences. The foregoing are examples of inadvertence, but there's another kind of peril. We are sometimes told that this or that invention would of course not be misused. No sane person would be so reckless. This is the only a madman argument. Whenever I hear it, and it's often trotted out in such debates, I remind myself that madmen really exist. Sometimes they achieve the highest levels of political power in modern industrial nations. This is the century of Hitler and Stalin, tyrants who posed the gravest dangers not just to the rest of the human family, but to their own people as well. In the winter and spring of 1945, Hitler ordered Germany to be destroyed, even as he wrote, "What the people need for elementary survival," because he believed the surviving Germans had betrayed him, and at any rate were inferior to those who had already died. If Hitler had had nuclear weapons, the threat of a counterstrike by Allied nuclear weapons, had there been any, is unlikely to have dissuaded him. It might have encouraged him. Can we humans be trusted with civilization-threatening technologies? If the chance is almost 1 in 1,000 that much of the human population will be killed by an impact in the next century, isn't it more likely that asteroid deflection technology will get into the wrong hands in another century? Some misanthropic sociopath like a Hitler or a Stalin, eager to kill everybody, a megalomaniac lusting after greatness and glory, a victim of ethnic violence bent on revenge, someone in the grip of unusually severe testosterone poisoning, some religious fanatic hastening the day of judgment, or just technicians, incompetent, or insufficiently vigilant in handling the controls and safeguards. Such people exist. The risks seem far worse than the benefits. The cure worse than the disease. The cloud of near-Earth asteroids through which the Earth plows may constitute a modern Cameroon marsh. It's easy to think that all of this must be very unlikely, mere anxious fantasy. Surely sober heads would prevail. Think of how many people would be involved in preparing and launching warheads, in space navigation, in detonating warheads, in checking what orbital perturbation each nuclear explosion has made, in herding the asteroid so it is on an impact trajectory with Earth, and so on. Isn't it noteworthy that although Hitler gave orders for the retreating Nazi troops to burn Paris and to lay waste to Germany itself, his orders were not carried out? Surely someone essential to the success of the deflection mission will recognize the danger. Even assurances that the project is designed to destroy some vile enemy nation would probably be disbelieved because the effects of collision are planet-wide. And anyway, it's very hard to make sure your asteroid excavates this monster crater in a particularly deserving nation. But now imagine a totalitarian state not overrun by enemy troops, but when thriving and self-confident. Imagine a tradition in which orders are obeyed without question. Imagine that those involved in the operation are supplied a cover story. The asteroid is about to impact the Earth, and it is their job to deflect it. But in order not to worry people needlessly, the operation must be performed in secret, in a military setting, with the command hierarchy firmly in place, compartmentalization of knowledge, general secrecy, and a cover story. Can we be confident that even apocalyptic orders would be disobeyed? Are we really sure that in the next decades and centuries and millennia, nothing like this might happen? How sure are we? It's no use saying that all technologies can be used for good or for ill. That is certainly true. But when the ill achieves a sufficiently apocalyptic scale, we may have to set limits on which technologies may be developed. In a way, we do this all the time because we can't afford to develop all technologies. Some are favored and some are not. Or constraints may have to be levied by the community of nations on madmen and autarchs and fanaticism. Tracking asteroids and comets is prudent. It's good science and it doesn't cost much. But knowing our weaknesses, why would we even consider now developing the technology to deflect small worlds? For safety, shall we imagine this technology in the hands of many nations, each providing checks and balances against misuse by another? This is nothing like the old nuclear balance of terror. It hardly inhibits some madman, intent on global catastrophe, to know that if he does not hurry, a rival may beat him to it. How confident can we be that the community of nations will be able to detect a cleverly designed, clandestine asteroid deflection in time to do something about it? If such a technology were developed, can any international safeguards be envisioned that have a reliability commensurate with the risk? Even if we restrict ourselves merely to surveillance, there's a risk. Imagine that in a generation we characterize the orbits of 30,000 objects of 100-meter diameter or more, and that this information is publicized, as of course it should be. Maps will be published showing near-Earth space black with the orbits of asteroids and comets, 30,000 swords of Damocles hanging over our heads, 10 times more than the number of stars visible to the naked eye under conditions of optimum atmospheric clarity. Public anxiety might be much greater in such a time of knowledge than in our current age of ignorance. There might be irresistible public pressure to develop means to mitigate even non-existent threats, which would then feed the danger that deflection technology would be misused. For this reason, asteroid discovery and surveillance may not be a mere neutral tool of future policy, but rather a kind of booby trap. To me, the only foreseeable solution is a combination of accurate orbit estimation, realistic threat assessment, and effective public education, so that in democracies at least, citizens can make their own informed decisions. This is a job for NASA. Near-Earth asteroids and means of altering their orbits are being looked at seriously. There is some sign that officials in the Department of Defense and the weapons laboratories are beginning to understand that there may be real dangers in planning to push asteroids around. Civilian and military scientists have met to discuss the subject. On first hearing about the asteroid hazard, many people think of it as a kind of Chicken Little fable. Goosey Lucy, newly arrived and in great excitement, is communicating the urgent news that the sky is falling. The tendency to dismiss the prospect of any catastrophe that we have not personally witnessed is in the long run very foolish. But in this case, it may be an ally of prudence. Meanwhile, we must still face the deflection dilemma. If we develop and deploy this technology, it may do us in. If we don't, some asteroid or comet may do us in. The resolution of the dilemma hinges, I think, on the fact that the likely timescales of the two dangers are very different. Short for the former, long for the latter. I like to think that our future involvement with near-Earth asteroids will go something like this. From ground-based observatories, we discover all the big ones, plot and monitor their orbits, determine rotation rates and compositions. Scientists are diligent in explaining the dangers, neither exaggerating nor muting the prospects. We send robotic spacecraft to fly by a few selected bodies, orbit them, land on them, and return surface samples to laboratories on Earth. Eventually, we send humans. Because of the low gravities, they will be able to make standing broad jumps of 10 kilometers or more into the sky and lob a baseball into orbit around the asteroid. Fully aware of the dangers, we make no attempts to alter trajectories until the potential for misuse of world-altering technologies is much less. That might take a while. If we're too quick in developing the technology to move worlds around, we may destroy ourselves. If we're too slow, we will surely destroy ourselves. The reliability of world political organizations and the confidence they inspire will have to make significant strides before they can be trusted to deal with a problem of this seriousness. At the same time, there seems to be no acceptable national solution. Who would feel comfortable with the means of world destruction in the hands of some dedicated or even potential enemy nation, whether or not our nation had comparable powers? The existence of interplanetary collision hazards, when widely understood, works to bring our species together. When facing a common danger, we humans have sometimes reached heights widely thought impossible. We have set aside our differences, at least until the danger passed. But this danger never passes. The asteroids, gravitationally churning, are slowly altering their orbits without warning. New comets come careening toward us from the trans-Plutonian darkness. There will always be a need to deal with them in a way that does not endanger us. By posing two different classes of peril, one natural, the other human-made, small near-Earth worlds provide a new and potent motivation to create effective transnational institutions and to unify the human species. It's hard to see any satisfactory alternative. In our usual jittery, two steps forward, one step back mode, we are moving toward unification anyway. There are powerful influences deriving from transportation and communications technologies, the interdependent world economy, and the global environmental crisis. The impact hazard merely hastens the pace. Eventually, cautiously, scrupulously careful to attempt nothing with asteroids that could inadvertently cause a catastrophe on Earth, I imagine we will begin to learn how to change the orbits of little non-metallic worlds smaller than 100 meters across. We begin with smaller explosions and slowly work our way up. We gain experience in changing the orbits of various asteroids and comets of different compositions and strengths. We try to determine which ones can be pushed around and which cannot. By the 22nd century, perhaps we move small worlds around the solar system using not nuclear explosions, but nuclear fusion engines or their equivalents. We insert small asteroids made of precious and industrial metals into Earth orbit. Gradually, we develop a defensive technology to deflect a large asteroid or comet that might in the foreseeable future hit the Earth, while, with meticulous care, we build layers of safeguards against misuse. Since the danger of misusing deflection technology seems so much greater than the danger of an imminent impact, we can afford to wait, take precautions, rebuild political institutions. For decades, certainly. Probably centuries. If we play our cards right and are not unlucky, we can pace what we do up there by what progress we're making down here. The two are in any case deeply connected. The asteroid hazard forces our hand. Eventually, we must establish a formidable human presence throughout the inner solar system. On an issue of this importance, I do not think we will be content with purely robotic means of mitigation. To do so safely, we must make changes in our political and international systems. While much about our future is cloudy, this conclusion seems a little more robust and independent of the vagaries of human institutions. In the long term, even if we were not the descendants of professional wanderers, even if we were not inspired by exploratory passions, some of us would still have to leave the Earth simply to ensure the survival of all of us. And once we're out there, we'll need bases, infrastructures. It would not be very long before some of us were living in artificial habitats and on other worlds. This is the first of two missing arguments omitted in our discussion of missions to Mars for a permanent human presence in space. Other planetary systems must face their own impact hazards, because small primordial worlds, of which asteroids and comets are remnants, are the stuff out of which planets form as well. After the planets are made, many of these planetesimals are left over. The average time between civilization-threatening impacts on Earth is perhaps 200,000 years, 20 times the age of our civilization. Very different waiting times may pertain to extraterrestrial civilizations, if they exist, depending on such factors as the physical and chemical characteristics of the planet and its biosphere, the biological and social nature of the civilization, and of course, the collision rate itself. Planets with higher atmospheric pressures will be protected against somewhat larger impactors, although the pressure cannot be much greater before greenhouse warming and other consequences make life improbable. If the gravity is much less than on Earth, impactors will make less energetic collisions and the hazard will be reduced, although it cannot be reduced very much before the atmosphere escapes to space. The impact rate in other planetary systems is uncertain. Our system contains two major populations of small bodies that feed potential impactors into Earth-crossing orbits. Both the existence of the source populations and the mechanisms that maintain the collision rate depend on how worlds are distributed. For example, our Oort cloud seems to have been populated by gravitational ejections of icy worldlets from the vicinity of Uranus and Neptune. If there are no planets that play the role of Uranus and Neptune in systems otherwise like our own, their Oort clouds may be much more thinly populated. Stars in open and globular stellar clusters, stars in double or multiple system, stars closer to the center of the galaxy, stars experiencing more frequent encounters with giant molecular clouds in interstellar space may all experience higher impact fluxes at their terrestrial planets. The cometary flux might be hundreds or thousands of times more at the Earth had the planet Jupiter never formed. According to a calculation by George Wetherill of the Carnegie Institution of Washington, in systems without Jupiter-like planets, the gravitational shield against comets is down and civilization-threatening impacts much more frequent. To a certain extent, increased fluxes of interplanetary objects might increase the rate of evolution, as the mammals that flourished and diversified after the Cretaceous-Tertiary collision wiped out the dinosaurs. But there must be a point of diminishing returns. Clearly, some flux is too high for the continuance of any civilization. One consequence of this train of argument is that Even if civilizations commonly arise on planets throughout the galaxy, few of them will be both long-lived and non-technological. Since hazards from asteroids and comets must apply to inhabited planets all over the galaxy, if there are such, intelligent beings everywhere will have to unify their home worlds politically, leave their planets, and move small nearby worlds around. Their eventual choice, as ours, is spaceflight or extinction. Chapter 19. Remaking the planets. Who could deny that man could somehow also make the heavens, could he only obtain the instruments and the heavenly material? Marsilio Ficino, the soul of man, circa 1474. In the midst of the Second World War, a young American writer named Jack Williamson envisioned a populated solar system. In the 22nd century, he imagined Venus would be settled by China, Japan, and Indonesia, Mars by Germany, and the moons of Jupiter by Russia. In the real world, Chinese space officials are proposing to send a 2-person astronaut capsule into orbit by the turn of the century. It would be propelled by a modified Long March 2E rocket and be launched from the Gobi Desert. If the Chinese economy exhibits even moderate continuing growth, much less the exponential growth that marked it in the early to mid-1990s, China may be one of the world's leading space powers by the middle of the 21st century or earlier. Those who spoke English, the language in which Williamson was writing, were confined to the asteroids and, of course, the Earth. The story, published in Astounding Science Fiction in July 1942, was called Collision Orbit and written under the pseudonym Will Stewart. Its plot hinged on the imminent collision of an uninhabited asteroid with a colonized one, and the search for a means of altering the trajectories of small worlds. Although no one on Earth was endangered, this may have been the first appearance, apart from newspaper comic strips, of asteroid collisions as a threat to humans. Comets impacting the Earth had been a staple peril. The environments of Mars and Venus were poorly understood in the early 1940s. It was conceivable that humans could live there without elaborate life support systems. But the asteroids were another matter. It was well known, even then, that asteroids were small, dry, airless worlds. If they were to be inhabited, especially by large numbers of people, these little worlds would somehow have to be fixed. In Collision Orbit, Williamson portrays a group of spatial engineers able to render such barren outposts clement. Coining a word, Williamson called the process of metamorphosis into an Earth-like world terraforming. He knew that the low gravity on an asteroid means that any atmosphere generated or transported there would quickly escape to space. So his key terraforming technology was paragravity, an artificial gravity that would hold a dense atmosphere. As nearly as we can tell today, paragravity is a physical impossibility. But we can imagine domed, transparent habitats on the surfaces of asteroids, as suggested by Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, or communities established in the insides of asteroids, as outlined in the 1920s by the British scientist J.D. Bernal. Because asteroids are small and their gravity's low, even massive subsurface construction might be comparatively easy. If a tunnel were dug clean through, you could jump in at one end and emerged some 45 minutes later at the other, oscillating up and down along the full diameter of this world indefinitely. Inside the right kind of asteroid, a carbonaceous one, you can find materials for manufacturing stone, metal, and plastic construction, and plentiful water. All you might need to build a subsurface closed ecological system, an underground garden. Implementation would require a significant step beyond what we have today. But, unlike paragravity, nothing in such a scheme seems impossible. All the elements can be found in contemporary technology. If there were sufficient reason, a fair number of us could be living on or in asteroids by the 22nd century. They would, of course, need a source of power, not just to sustain themselves, but, as Bernal suggested, to move their asteroidal homes around. It does not seem so big a step from explosive alteration of asteroid orbits to a more gentle means of propulsion a century or two later. If an oxygen atmosphere were generated from chemically bound water, then organics could be burned to generate power just as fossil fuels are burned on the Earth today. Solar power could be considered, although for the main belt asteroids, the intensity of sunlight is only about 10% what it is on Earth. Still, we could imagine vast fields of solar panels covering the surfaces of inhabited asteroids and converting sunlight into electricity. Photovoltaic technology is routinely used in Earth-orbiting spacecraft and is in increasing use on the surface of the Earth today. But while that might be enough to warm and light the homes of these descendants, it does not seem adequate to change asteroid orbits. For that, Williamson proposed using antimatter. Antimatter is just like ordinary matter, with one significant difference. Consider hydrogen. An ordinary hydrogen atom consists of a positively charged proton on the inside and a negatively charged electron on the outside. An atom of anti-hydrogen consists of a negatively charged proton on the inside and a positively charged electron, also called a positron, on the outside. The protons, whatever the sign of their charges, have the same mass, and the electrons, whatever the sign of their charges, have the same mass. Particles with opposite charges attract. A hydrogen atom and an anti-hydrogen atom are both stable, because in both cases, the positive and negative electrical charges precisely balance. Antimatter is not some hypothetical construct from the perfervid musings of science fiction writers or theoretical physicists. Antimatter exists. Physicists make it in nuclear accelerators. It can be found in high-energy cosmic rays. So why don't we hear more about it? Why has no one held up a lump of antimatter for our inspection? Because matter and antimatter, when brought into contact, violently annihilate each other, disappearing in an intense burst of gamma rays. We cannot tell whether something is made of matter or antimatter just by looking at it. The spectroscopic properties of, for example, hydrogen and anti-hydrogen are identical. Albert Einstein's answer to the question of why we see only matter and not antimatter was matter one, by which he meant that in our sector of the universe at least, after almost all the matter and antimatter interacted and annihilated each other long ago, there was some of what we call ordinary matter left over. As far as we can tell today, from gamma ray astronomy and other means, the universe is made almost entirely of matter. The reason for this engages the deepest cosmological issues, which need not detain us here. But if there was only a one particle in a billion difference in the preponderance of matter over antimatter at the beginning. Even this would be enough to explain the universe we see today. Williamson imagined that humans in the 22nd century would move asteroids around by the controlled mutual annihilation of matter and antimatter. All the resulting gamma rays, if collimated, would make a potent rocket exhaust. The antimatter would be available in the main asteroid belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, because this was his explanation for the existence of the asteroid belt. In the remote past, he proposed, an intruder antimatter worldlet arrived in the solar system from the depths of space, impacted and annihilated what was then an Earth-like planet, fifth from the sun. The fragments of this mighty collision are the asteroids, and some of them are still made of antimatter. Harness an anti-asteroid? Williamson recognized that this might be tricky, and you can move worlds around at will. At the time, Williamson's ideas were futuristic, but far from foolish. Some of collision orbit can be considered visionary. Today, however, we have good reason to believe that there are no significant amounts of antimatter in the solar system, and that the asteroid belt, far from being a fragmented terrestrial planet, is an enormous array of small bodies prevented, by the gravitational tides of Jupiter, from forming an Earth-like world. However, we do generate very small amounts of antimatter in nuclear accelerators today, and we will probably be able to manufacture much larger amounts by the 22nd century. Because it is so efficient, converting all of the matter into energy, E equals mc squared, with 100% efficiency, perhaps antimatter engines will be a practical technology by then, vindicating Williamson. Failing that, what energy sources can we realistically expect to be available to reconfigure asteroids, to light them, warm them, and move them around? The sun shines by jamming protons together and turning them into helium nuclei. Energy is released in the process, although with less than 1% the efficiency of the annihilation of matter and antimatter. But even proton-proton reactions are far beyond anything we can realistically imagine for ourselves in the near future. The required temperatures are much too high. Instead of jamming protons together, though, we might use heavier kinds of hydrogen. We already do so in thermonuclear weapons. Deuterium is a proton bound by nuclear forces to a neutron. Tritium is a proton bound by nuclear forces to two neutrons. It seems likely that in another century, we will have practical power schemes that involve the controlled fusion of deuterium and tritium, and of deuterium and helium. Deuterium and tritium are present as minor constituents in water, on Earth, and other worlds. The kind of helium needed for fusion, helium-3, two protons and a neutron make up its nucleus, has been implanted over billions of years by the solar wind in the surfaces of the asteroids. These processes are not nearly as efficient as the proton-proton reactions in the sun, but they could provide enough power to run a small city for a year from a load of ice, only a few meters in size. Fusion reactors seem to be coming along too slowly to play a major role in solving or even significantly mitigating global warming. But by the 22nd century, they ought to be widely available. With fusion rocket engines, it will be possible to move asteroids and comets around the inner solar system, taking a main belt asteroid, for example, and inserting it into orbit around the Earth. A world 10 kilometers across could be transported from Saturn, say, to Mars through nuclear burning of the hydrogen in an icy comet a kilometer across. Again, I'm assuming a time of much greater political stability and safety. Put aside, for the moment, any qualms you might have about the ethics of rearranging worlds or our ability to do so without catastrophic consequences. Digging out the insides of worldlets, reconfiguring them for human habitation, and moving them from one place in the solar system to another seems to be within our grasp in another century or two. Perhaps by then, we will have adequate international safeguards as well. But what about transforming the surface environments not of asteroids or comets, but of planets? Could we live on Mars? If we wanted to set up housekeeping on Mars, it's easy to see that, in principle at least, we could do it. There's abundant sunlight. There's plentiful water in the rocks and in underground and polar ice. The atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide. It seems likely that in self-contained habitats, perhaps domed enclosures, we could grow crops, manufacture oxygen from water, recycle wastes. At first, we'd be dependent on commodities we supplied from Earth. But in time, we'd manufacture more and more of them ourselves. We'd become increasingly self-sufficient. The domed enclosures, even if made of ordinary glass, would let in the visible sunlight and screen out the sun's ultraviolet rays. With oxygen masks and protective garments, but nothing as bulky and cumbersome as a spacesuit. We could leave these enclosures to go exploring, or to build another dome village and farms. It seems very evocative of the American pioneering experience, but with at least one major difference. In the early stages, large subsidies are essential. The technology required is too expensive for some poor family like my grandparents a century ago, to pay their own passage to Mars. The early Martian pioneers will be sent by governments and will have highly specialized skills. But in a generation or two, when children and grandchildren are born there, and especially when self-sufficiency is within reach, that will begin to change. Youngsters born on Mars will be given specialized training in the technology essential for survival in this new environment. The settlers will become less heroic and less exceptional. The full range of human strengths and deficiencies will begin to assert themselves. Gradually, precisely because of the difficulty of getting from Earth to Mars, a unique Martian culture will begin to emerge. Distinct aspirations and fears tied to the environment they live in, distinct technologies, distinct social problems, distinct solutions. And, as has occurred in every similar circumstance throughout human history, a gradual sense of cultural and political estrangement from the mother world. Great ships will arrive, carrying essential technology from Earth. New families of settlers, scarce resources. It is hard to know, on the basis of our limited knowledge of Mars, whether they will go home empty or whether they will carry with them something found only on Mars, something considered very valuable on Earth. Initially, much of the scientific investigation of samples of the Martian surface will be done on Earth, but in time, the scientific study of Mars and its moons, Phobos and Deimos, will be done from Mars. Eventually, as has happened with virtually every other form of human transportation, interplanetary travel will become accessible to people of ordinary means, to scientists pursuing their own research projects, to settlers fed up with Earth, even to venturesome tourists. And of course, there will be explorers. If the time ever came when it was possible to make the Martian environment much more Earth-like, so protective garments, oxygen masks, and domed farmlands and cities could be dispensed with, the attraction and accessibility of Mars would be increased manyfold. The same, of course, would be true for any other world, which could be engineered so that humans could live there, without elaborate contrivances to keep the planetary environment out. We would feel much more comfortable in our adopted home if an intact dome or spacesuit weren't all that stood between us and death. But perhaps I exaggerate the dangers. People who live in the Netherlands seem at least as well-adjusted and carefree as other inhabitants of Northern Europe, yet their dikes are all that stand between them and the sea. Recognizing the speculative nature of the question and the limitations in our knowledge, is it nevertheless possible to envision terraforming the planets? We need look no further than our own world to see that humans are now able to alter planetary environments in a profound way. Depletion of the ozone layer, global warming from an increased greenhouse effect, and global cooling from nuclear war are all ways in which present technology can significantly alter the environment of our world. And in each case, as an inadvertent consequence of doing something else. If we had intended to alter our planetary environment, we would be fully able to generate still greater change. As our technology becomes more powerful, we will be able to work still more profound changes. But just as in parallel parking, it's easier to get out of a parking place than into one. It's easier to destroy a planetary environment than to move it into a narrowly prescribed range of temperatures, pressures, compositions, and so on. We already know of a multitude of desolate and uninhabitable worlds, and, with very narrow margins, only one green and clement one. This is a major conclusion from early in the era of spacecraft exploration of the solar system. In altering the Earth, or any world with an atmosphere, we must be very careful about positive feedbacks, where we nudge an environment a little bit and it takes off on its own. A little cooling leading to runaway glaciation, as may have happened on Mars, or a little warming to a runaway greenhouse effect, as happened on Venus. It is not at all clear that our knowledge is sufficient to this purpose. As far as I know, the first suggestion in the scientific literature about terraforming the planets was made in a 1961 article I wrote about Venus. I was pretty sure then that Venus had a surface temperature well above the normal boiling point of water, produced by a carbon dioxide water vapor greenhouse effect. I imagined seeding its high clouds with genetically engineered microorganisms that would take carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and water out of the atmosphere and convert them into organic molecules. The more carbon dioxide removed, the smaller the greenhouse effect and the cooler the surface. The microbes would be carried down through the atmosphere toward the ground, where they would be fried. So water vapor would be returned to the atmosphere. But the carbon from the carbon dioxide would be converted irreversibly by the high temperatures into graphite or some other involatile form of carbon. Eventually, the temperatures would fall below the boiling point and the surface of Venus would become habitable, dotted with pools and lakes of warm water. The idea was soon taken up by a number of science fiction authors in the continuing dance between science and science fiction, in which the science stimulates the fiction, and the fiction stimulates a new generation of scientists, a process benefiting both genres. But as the next step in the dance, it is now clear that seeding Venus with special photosynthetic microorganisms will not work. Since 1961, we've discovered that the clouds of Venus are a concentrated solution of sulfuric acid, which makes the genetic engineering rather more challenging. But that in itself is not a fatal flaw. There are microorganisms that live out their lives in concentrated solutions of sulfuric acid. Here is the fatal flaw. In 1961, I thought the atmospheric pressure of the surface of Venus was a few bars, a few times the surface pressure on Earth. We now know it to be 90 bars, so that if the scheme worked, the result would be a surface buried in hundreds of meters of fine graphite, and an atmosphere made of 65 bars of almost pure molecular oxygen. Whether we would first implode under the atmospheric pressure or spontaneously burst into flames in all that oxygen is an open question. However, long before so much oxygen could build up, the graphite would spontaneously burn back into carbon dioxide, short-circuiting the process. At best, such a scheme can carry the terraforming of Venus only part way. Let's assume that by the early 22nd century, we have comparatively inexpensive heavy lift vehicles so we can carry large payloads to other worlds. Abundant and powerful fusion reactors and well-developed genetic engineering. All three assumptions are likely, given current trends. Could we terraform the planets? James Pollack of NASA's Ames Research Center and I surveyed this problem. Here's a summary of what we found. Venus. Clearly, the problem with Venus is its massive greenhouse effect. If we could reduce the greenhouse effect almost to zero, the climate might be balmy. But a 90-bar carbon dioxide atmosphere is oppressively thick. Over every postage stamp-sized square inch of surface, the air weighs as much as 6 professional football players piled one on top of another. Making all that go away will take some doing. Imagine bombarding Venus with asteroids and comets. Each impact would blow away some of the atmosphere. To blow away almost all of it, though, would require using up more big asteroids and comets than there are, at least in the planetary part of the solar system. Even if that many potential impactors existed, even if we could make them all collide with Venus, this is the overkill approach to the impact hazard problem, think what we would have lost. Who knows what wonders, what practical knowledge they contain. We would also obliterate much of Venus' gorgeous surface geology, which we've just begun to understand and which may teach us much about the Earth. This is an example of brute force terraforming. I suggest we want to steer entirely clear of such methods, even if someday we'll be able to afford them, which I very much doubt. We want something more elegant, more subtle, more respectful of the environments of other worlds. A microbial approach has some of those virtues, but does not do the trick as we've just seen. We can imagine pulverizing a dark asteroid and spreading the powder through the upper atmosphere of Venus or carrying such dust up from the surface. This would be the physical equivalent of nuclear winter or the Cretaceous-Tertiary post-impact climate. If the sunlight reaching the ground is sufficiently attenuated, the surface temperature must fall. But by its very nature, this option plunges Venus into deep gloom, with daytime light levels perhaps only as bright as on a moonlit night on Earth. The oppressive, crushing 90-bar atmosphere would remain untouched. Since the emplaced dust would sediment out every few years, the layer would have to be replenished in the same period of time. Perhaps such an approach would be acceptable for short exploratory missions, but the environment generated seems very stark for a self-sustaining human community on Venus. We could use a giant artificial sunshade in orbit around Venus to cool the surface, but it would be enormously expensive, as well as having many of the deficiencies of the dust layer. However, if the temperatures could be lowered sufficiently, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would rain out. There would be a transitional time of carbon dioxide oceans on Venus. If those oceans could be covered over to prevent